Hi, everybody, and welcome to Phillies Backstage. I'm Tom Burgoyne, joined by John Brazier. And, John, we have baseball royalty in the booth tonight.
We have a Hall of Famer. Now, we've talked to some Hall of Famers, right?
That's right.
Not often, but we have it's probably the interview who's the Hall of Famer, the most recent Hall of Famer. Have we ever had, a really recent Hall of Famer?
When did we talk to Tomey?
Well, after his.
Was it after his? Okay.
Well, let's bring him on.
Yes.
Tim Kirchen, who's the class of 2022, right?
Yeah, so after I won the award, Johnny Bench, the greatest catcher of all time, calls me on the phone the next morning and says, congratulations, welcome to the club, you're one of us now. So let's be clear, I'm not in their club, I'm not one of them,
but
I'm a player.
Cool, how cool is that?
Hey, you're in Harry Callis' club, right?
Jason Stark.
Really cool. So Johnny's voice gets really soft after congratulating me, and he goes, you know, Tim, it's moments like this that bring you back to Little League. And I was about ready to cry again. And he said, and let's face it, you could still fit into a Little League uniform. Johnny. Really appreciate it.
I mean, but really think about that. You know, obviously you were a baseball player growing up. When you were playing the Little League fields in Bethesda, Maryland, if someone said to you at 10 years old in 40 years you're going to be – or fit whatever, you're going to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. I mean, you would have looked at him like you're completely crazy, right?
Right. I would have said that about 5 years ago, too, by the way. And by the way, I went to Walter Johnson High School, named after the greatest pitcher of all time.
Yep.
So there was some destiny involved there. My senior year, one of my gym teachers came up to me after one of my stories in the school paper, which was called The Pitch, by the way. And the yearbook was called The Windup. So after one story, one of my gym teachers said, Tim, that might be the worst story I've ever read in the school paper. I hope you're not planning on making this your life's work.
And then I did.
Wait, was that part of your speech? Did you
of course
it was. Had to put that
of course
speech,
it
right?
was because it really drove me to think, am I really this bad? And if I am, I better get a whole lot better than this. So I just kept writing and writing, and eventually I figured it out.
Something tells me you could have probably just cut and paste Jason Stark's speech, because I think Jason was the same way. I think he couldn't believe that he was on that stage making that speech at that time, because, and you know, we all love reading Jason because he just exudes a love of the game. And you certainly, Tim, seem to have it every time you're writing or when you're on the air.
Well, thank you. And then, so for the real induction, I was honored on Saturday. The real induction is on Sunday. And I'm on a bus with only Hall of Famers and me. Like, who does not belong on this bus? So there's one seat open. It's next to me, and this very regal, elegant-looking gentleman comes up and says, can I sit next to you? And it was Sandy Koufax.
Oh, wow. My gosh. Right.
So I've met Sandy before. I've interviewed him before. But still, I got 15 minutes now with Sandy Koufax. Now, he could be a little tricky if you ask the wrong question. I know this because I did it once, right? So I decide I'm going to pull an audible here because I love basketball. He was a great player at the University of Cincinnati. So I asked him, I said, could you dunk it easily? This is my first question. Could you dunk it easily when you were in college? And he goes, yes, I could. He goes, look how big my hands are. You know, he's got historically large hands. And he told me his sleeve length was 37 inches. So he said, I've got these unbelievably long arms and these huge hands. And even though I'm only 6 feet tall, I could dunk it easily. 15 minutes on the bus with Sandy Koufax at the Hall of Fame, and we didn't talk about baseball once because he loved basketball also that much.
Now, Jason Stark told me that you are a very good basketball player, and he said you were also a fierce competitor.
Well, none of that is true, but I will tell you that I used to play basketball with Cal Ripken. It was a raging conflict of interest. I should have never done this. But I end up in the same gym with him. I end up playing 100 games with him. And here's what he liked to do. If we were on opposite teams and, his man was late getting down on offense, Cal Ripken used to like to pick me up at the end line and guard me the entire way down the floor.
Yes.
He's a foot taller than I am, weighs 100 pounds more than I do, and he would harass me all the way down the court.
Could you shake him?
I finally had to look at him, and I said, would you please leave me alone? Would you please stop trying for 1 second? And he said, no. And that's why he ended up in the Baseball Hall of Fame, because that pickup basketball game was really important to him, and he was going to play it right, and he was going to win. And that's how he did everything in his life.
I got to tell you, you know, back to the Hall of Fame weekend, Tim, I mean, did you find your – I mean, you're around all these great players. Yes, you have interviewed everybody. But that weekend especially, you got everybody around you. Did you feel like you wanted to interview guys, or did you just sit back and let it come to you? And
well, I was able to sit back because I was too nervous to do anything else. I've never been more scared in my life. If I had screwed up that speech, I would have never forgiven myself. But fortunately, I got through it. And if I may, I get through the speech, so now I'm finally relaxed. We're out on the veranda, and Johnny Bench, the same Johnny Bench who made fun of me, comes out to the veranda, and he says, come with me. And he and I sat on the veranda at the Otisaga Hotel, and just the two of us.
Awesome.
And he says, I want you to look at that lake out there, and I want you to not say a word for 1 minute. I want you to look at that lake and think about where you are, how you got here, and how many people got you here. And I looked at that lake with the greatest catcher of all time sitting next to me. And I teared up. It was one of the most powerful moments of my whole life. He invites all the first-time Hall of Fame players to do that, to make sure they understand where they are. This time, he invited a writer to go out there, and I'll never forget that.
So he's like the dean of the Hall of Famers. Obviously, he's not the oldest.
Right, but he's the MC. So on Friday night, when the new Hall of Famers are in, the only people allowed in the private dinner are the Hall of Famers, and Johnny Bench is the MC of the night. And he welcomes the newcomers in. I told Barry Larkin, I said, I'm told this is the greatest part of Hall of Fame weekend. And after Johnny introduced Barry Larkin into the hall, Barry came to me and said, you can't believe how great that was on Friday night, because it was just us and Johnny was leading the way.
So let's go back to your career that got you started. So you went to University of Maryland, right? And you did journalism school.
Right.
And one of your first jobs, if I'm not correct, is in Dallas, right? You worked for the Dallas Morning Star?
I worked for the Dallas Morning News, but I had already lost two jobs by that point at age 24, because the newspapers for which I was working, the Washington Post and the Baltimore News American, essentially folded while I was there. It went away. Remember when the Philadelphia Bulletin went down?
Sure.
That's when the Star went down the same time.
And the Post?
Yeah, I lost two jobs in 2 months.
Wow.
And that's when I ended up going to Dallas in January of 82.
And then, again, Jason gave me some info. He said one of your first jobs was to go to the house of, I think, the Dallas Cowboys coach.
No. It's close. The SMU coach is Ron Meyer, and we get a tip that Ron Meyer, the SMU coach, is going to be the next Patriots coach. This is a huge story. All of our football writers are traveling, so my boss says, Tim, you have to do this story. Call Ron Meyer on the phone. I call him 50 times, phone's off the hook. He goes, you have to go to his house. I've been in town a week. I didn't know how to get to my house, let alone his house. And I didn't know Ron Meyer from Oscar Meyer, believe me. So I finally get to the door. It's 10 o'clock at night. I tap on the door. Remember, this is 82. I'm looking a lot younger than I do today, and I'm even smaller than I am today. And I say, hi, I'm Tim Kirkjian with the Dallas Morning News. And he goes, oh, okay, how much do we owe you this month? So he
thought you were the paper boy.
I'm not the paper boy. I don't know whether to laugh or to cry. Well, long story, he lets me in. He lies to me. I'm not going to the New England Patriots. I call in my story to the office. Yeah. He calls me 5 minutes later at my apartment and said, your competitor from the other paper just showed up. I didn't want to get you in trouble your first week on the job, so I'm going to tell you the truth. And then I got my story in the paper correctly the next day because he felt so bad. So, yes, that was the night I decided I'm not going to be chasing any college football coaches around. This is the sport I love. This is the only
baseball
sport I really want to cover.
Now, Tim, and you're in Philadelphia, and here you are. This was the 80s. And to me, and I grew up reading all four newspapers because we had the Philadelphia Journal for a few years there too, but the Bolt and the Daily News, the Inquirer, great writers. Who were some of your, I guess, your inspirations, whether it's growing up or in Philadelphia particularly? Did you have some favorites?
Oh, of course. In Washington, I worked with Dan Shaughnessy, who's now at the Boston Globe and is also in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Peter Gammons, for me, also in the Hall of Fame, is the greatest baseball writer of all time. Jason Stark taught me, better than anyone, how to look for and find great stats and great notes. So those are my three mentors in the business, Jason, Peter, and Dan Shaughnessy. But the guys in Philadelphia were tremendous. And this was at a time, you guys remember this, you'd go into a city and I would buy all four newspapers because that was the business. There's no better job that I've ever had than being a beat guy for a newspaper. And the people I used to read here and everywhere else, it's just so sad to me that the newspaper business isn't what it used to
and
be.
And I love, like, especially Jason, that they would find guys, players, or coaches or executives that had great personality, right? So whenever I think of Jason, he'd track down Ralph Kiner. And Ralph Kiner would have all kinds of quotes. Or he'd find
there's Ralph always Kiner, like, I mean, is
that, have you done that, like, through your career? You find, like,
I have my whole list of guys. If somebody, if I needed something funny, I'd call Andy Van Slyke or
Larry Anderson.
Yes. Larry Anderson told me once, he's a terrible hitting pitcher. He was 2-for-2 to start one season. As a relief pitcher, he's 2-for-2. And he said, I should be hitting 2,000 if I'm 2-for-2. That way, if I make an out the next time, my average would only fall to 1,500. This is how Larry used to think.
I think he also said 3 hits in 10 years, so he's batting 300.
Yeah, 300.
Right. So, I had my whole list of guys. Yeah. I had my go-to guys, Rich Donnelly. Eventually, Krucky became one of my guys.
Ask you about John.
After he screamed at me once, I called Krucky. Krucky got hit by a pitch for the first time in his career after, like, 1,800 plate appearances. He was, like, 7 years into the league before he got hit. I was at Sports Illustrated, and he didn't know me very well, and I called to ask him about the first time he got hit by a pitch. And the silence on the other end of the phone was deafening, and he said, are you telling me that you just called me to bother me, to tell me that I got hit by a pitch for the first time? He said, do you not have anything better to do with your life? And here it is 30 years later. I still don't have anything better to do with my life. But, yes, I had my guys then. I still have them now because I want to talk to someone who's going to teach me something, entertain me, make me smile, make me laugh. I don't need to talk to the best player on the field. I need to talk to someone who's going to be the most entertaining and informative person on the field.
Now, speaking of entertaining, what was it like working side-by-side with John Kruk?
Oh, my gosh. So this is so classic. This happens all the time. Krucky bus trip with him. I mean, I would spend 2 straight weeks with him. Me and him. And we're on the bus, and he would just routinely look at me and say, did I ever tell you about the time? And now comes a story that no one has ever heard or will not believe, but it's all true. He says, did I ever tell you about the time I shot a deer in the hot tub? And I went, what? And with Krucky, you have to ask a question.
Krucky,
were you in the hot tub?
Right.
Was the deer in the hot tub? Or were both of you in the hot tub? Because you never know with Krucky. So he says, no, I'm in high school, and I'm in my hot tub, and I got my shotgun leaning up against the hot tub. And then he pauses to look at me as if I'm now going to say, yeah, Krucky, that's where I keep my shotgun. And he stood up butt naked in high school, shot a deer, and sat back down. That's one of 1,000 stories that John Kruk told me that made me laugh out loud.
Can I ask you? Okay, so when Kruk retired, he did a year or two local TV, I think, for Prism. And then ESPN, he did that Best Damn Sports Show, but he wound up going to ESPN, did some color stuff, and I thought at the time, like, he could be the John Madden of baseball, John Kruk, as a color guy, the Sunday night game for the next 20 years. They wound up putting him in the studio. Do you think Krucker would have been that guy if he had just done color for 20 years, or did you like him in the studio?
Well, Krucky could have been whatever he wanted to be because, A, he's hilarious. But what people don't understand, seriously, is what a student of the game that he is. That stuff I learned just from sitting next to him and him explaining, watch where the right fielder moves on this play. He told me as we're sitting there one day, he said, in 1993, the year they went to the World Series, he said, I bet we didn't turn 2 5-4-3 double plays the whole season because Dave Hollins had a bad elbow and he couldn't make the throw to second because he would throw a slider and he couldn't do it. So he would only throw it to first. So I looked it up. and the Phillies in 93 pulled two 5-4-3 double plays.
I didn't know that.
The whole season.
You wrote a book on this season.
About that season.
The whole season.
Nice book.
And they went to the World Series. But these were the little things that Krucky would teach me. He claims he never taught me anything. He taught me so much, and he made me laugh so many times. So I have had – I probably worked with 100 different former players at ESPN, Larry Boa, a million others, and Krucky's certainly in the top five.
Can I? You talked about the 93 season. I think you were with Sports Illustrated during those years in 93.
Yeah.
So what do you remember from that team? Were they one of your favorites, and did you cover them
a little bit? I did a really big story on the 93 Phillies, and I'll never forget. They were in Chicago when I went paid my final visit for this story, and it's 9 o'clock in the morning. It's a day game. We're just now walking into the clubhouse. Kurt Schilling meets me at the door. And I know him because I covered his first major league start in Baltimore, okay? So he looks at me and he goes, "Be careful. The animals are out of their cages today."
At 9 a.m.
At 9 a.m. And meanwhile, Mitch Williams walks by the front door. He's totally naked. Right. And he has a burrito at 9 o'clock in the morning that is the size and consistency of a brick. That's what he's eating at 9 a.m. And there's never been a team that I've ever been around that was like that. Of course, you know that time. And there will never be another team like that again because of the camaraderie. They would stay after every game, as you know, drink beer and eat pizza. Krucky told me I should never repeat this. Like 14 guys on the team got a divorce that year. Yeah, no. So I'm not suggesting you should be eating pizza, drinking beer, and getting a divorce. I'm just saying what they were doing together. And as they were drinking beer and eating pizza, they were talking about baseball. And we don't do that anymore. And I'm sad about that because I really think that made them a better team. And I think that was part of baseball lore.
Now, for me, I started in 94. So obviously a lot of people from the 93 team were on the 94 team. And I just remember as a young front office PR person, going into the locker room, and there's landmines everywhere. You had Dave Hollins, you had Mitch, you had Lenny, you got Kruk,
Inkleville,
but then you had Frank, the clubhouse guy. Then you had
all dumped on.
Yeah, you had dumped on everyone else. Then you had Fregosi, you had Boa, you had Vuk. I mean, there was no safe space, right? For a reporter, front office person, fanatic.
Well, John's got his Darren Dalton Foundation shirt on, and Dutch was the guy who would come out and talk to the
every
media.
Night,
right, Tim?
Every night. And that was part of the reason that he was the leader of that team. Pitcher has a terrible day, especially a young pitcher. Dutch's guy comes out every day, sits there on that table in the middle of the room, and everyone talks to him. And if a guy had a bad day, Dutch would always protect him. If he had a great day, he would tell everyone how great he was. This is how good Dutch was. Schilling told me once, San Francisco, he's got a one-hitter shutout going through 7 innings. He hadn't thrown anything but a fastball for 7 innings. And he says to Dutch, "Hey, shouldn't I throw something other than a fastball?" And Dutch looks at him and goes, "You idiot. You've pitched 7 innings and haven't hit a ball hard yet. Why would we throw something else? They can't hit your fastball. Just keep throwing it." And Schilling threw like 2 breaking balls out of 102 and pitched a shutout.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned there's so many characters in the game. So, obviously, in all the years you've been in baseball, you've seen them all, right? I know you've written a bunch of books. One of the books had Don Zimmer in the title, right? But talk about Zim, your relationship with Don Zimmer.
Well, Zim had a really important part in my life because I was a young writer in 82 covering the Rangers. Now, I had covered the Orioles as a semi-beat guy, but it doesn't really count until you're the actual beat guy, when you're in charge of the team. So it's the 82 Rangers. Zim has no idea who I am, and I've just joined the team. I just joined the Dallas Morning News, and I drag myself into his office in the middle of May. They've lost 11 games in a row. They are terrible. And Zim, at this point, he's one of my guys. I'm talking to him every day. He's the manager. So he looks at this forlorn look on my face, and he goes, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "Zim, I got to tell you, covering this team isn't nearly as much fun as I thought it would be." And he looks at me, and I'm quoting here. He goes, He said, why don't you shut up? He says, look at yourself. You're young. You're good looking. You got your whole life in front of you. He said, look at me. I'm old. I'm fat. I'm bald. I'm ugly. I got a plate in my head, and I got this team to manage. I'm the one with all the worries. So quit complaining and recognize how fortunate you are to be covering Major League Baseball. And, John, Tom, this was in a seminal moment in my career, is that instead of complaining that I'm covering a bad Major League team, I was thrilled that I was covering any Major League team, and that was the biggest lesson that Zim taught me.
And Dickie Knowles is on that team, right?
Oh, my gosh. Right-handed pitcher Dickie Knowles. Boy, he – I think the last person in the world I would ever want to get in a fight with was Dickie Knowles. He was the toughest guy in the world. He has since, of course, turned his whole life around. He helps kids who went through what he went through. But I'll tell you, if we ever needed anyone to get knocked down in a box, Dickie was the first one to hand up. I'll knock him down whatever you like. That's what I do.
All right, one of the Fanatics' favorite people in baseball that's a non-Philly is Bruce Bochy, right? So talk about your relationship with Bruce Bochy.
All right, well, first off, Boch is one of the greats of all time, a first ballot Hall of Fame manager, and he wore a helmet, still does, size 8 1/4. 8 1/4, the next level is 9.
That's why the Fanatic loves him.
So he has the biggest head in the history of baseball. He told me, he said, I got traded twice, and I had to bring my helmet with me, and they would spray paint it the new colors of my new team because no one had a helmet that fit me. So he hit a walk-off homer once against Nolan Ryan, the only player ever to hit a walk-off homer off of Nolan Ryan.
That's amazing.
And so they run, and he's a backup catcher. He's not a good player. They run a red carpet from the beginning of the clubhouse all the way to his locker, and in his locker is a six-pack of beer with ice sitting in his 8 1/4 helmet. So they all celebrate, and Terry Kennedy, the catcher on the Padres, looked at me years later and said, you know, you can get a six-pack of beer in a lot of guys' helmets, but only in Boch's helmet can you get a six-pack of beer with ice.
With ice. Nice.
The best. Bruce Bochy, nobody made fun of himself better than him.
And he's having
and that's another reason he's such a great manager is he never took himself too serious.
Yeah, they're the best. They're the best. I know we got to kind of get close to wrapping up. I know John's got a quiz, but we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about the 2023 Phillies. In particular, Bryce Harper. I mean, what he's done to come back after to come back so quickly after his surgery. You know, what do you think?
160 days after surgery, he's playing in a major league game. He's not just playing, he's raking. I don't know how he did that. But we heard this story from Rob Thompson the other day. In spring training this year, Bryce is trying to come back, and he's taking BP, and he gets hit in the foot with a pitch in BP in spring training. And Rob says, well we got to get that looked at. Are you going to be okay? Don't hit anymore or whatever. So Bryce Harper looks at Rob Thompson and goes, I don't bruise. And I don't swell, I will be fine tomorrow. So the next day, Rob Thompson looks at Bryce Harper's foot, and there isn't a mark on it.
Unbelievable.
I don't swell, and I don't bruise. I bruise when I type too much. But this is who Bryce Harper is. This is why I believe this team is going to turn this thing around. There's too much talent here, and Bryce Harper and the rest of them eventually are going to figure this out.
Agreed. Yep.
Now, Tim, obviously we are here on ALS Awareness Night, and we know that your brother, who you're very close to, was diagnosed with ALS. So what does tonight mean to you, and talk about your brother?
Well, it's a really important night, and my brother is really struggling now. He's 67. He was diagnosed almost 3 years ago, and he can't walk anymore. He can barely talk. He's got a feeding tube, and yet his spirits are great. So here's really the only couple stories you need to hear about my brother. A year and a half after being diagnosed, he was a great college baseball player. So his college, Catholic University, asked him to throw out the ceremonial first pitch at their only fall date of the season, doubleheader at Mount St. Mary's. So the coach gives him a jersey that says M. Kirkchen, number 2, on the back, because that's the number he wore for 4 years at Catholic U. My brother goes out. He can't even hold a baseball anymore because his hands don't work. And he and I play catch. We figure it out, and he goes out and throws an athletic strike to the plate on the first ball ceremony. Then he looks to his right, and his immediate family, including me, we're all wearing the same M. Kirkchen 2 jerseys. And then he looks further to his right, and the entire Catholic University team, All 47 players are wearing Anna Kirchin jerseys, number two on the back. And that's the only first time I'd ever seen him cry since the ordeal began, because he looked at me and goes, I can't believe they're doing this for me. That's my brother. So 3 months after that, I throw out the first ball at the Nationals game, and my brother caught it. It's unbelievable.
Wow, it
2 years into ALS that he could throw a thrown baseball from 40 feet, and he caught it right here like a ball player. That's my brother, but he's fighting it. He's fighting it, and he's losing right now. But he's going to recover, and he's going to live a lot longer. But this is a wretched, insidious, devastating disease, and I pray for anyone and any family that is connected to it.
And we're happy you're here. Of course, thoughts go out to your brother too, and the Phillies have a long history of supporting ALS, and tonight will be another special night. So we're real happy you're here, Tim.
Well, thank you.
Tim's going to be on the broadcast tonight.
Yes.
And he's going to be on the pregame show with Murph and
maybe meet some patients.
Greeting some of the patients and everything. So thank you for that.
My pleasure.
John, you want to do this?
I think we are ready for the quiz. I don't know if Tim's ready for the quiz.
What pressure, right?
Best quiz he had was Catholic U, probably.
And, Tom, what do we have to win, by the way?
You know what?
If he wins, which he will.
We just gave out the
Philly. He's an author, too, by the way.
I know. So that's why we came up with a special Philly Fanatics Busiest Offseason. It's the latest Fanatic Kids book. He's got 19 of them out there. And I actually got the Fanatic to sign it. And it says, to Tim, from your favorite mascot, the Philly Fanatics. So, but you got to get 6 of 8, Tim. I know you would love to have that book, but if you don't
get 6 of 8. You have to get 6 of 8.
6 of 8. You got to get 6 of 8. Wow. So,
yeah, so get your mitts off that book.
I thought it was a gimme, but obviously
no gimme.
Not.
There are no gimmies on
the Phillies
backstage.
You have to earn this, but I think you'll do well. All right.
Thanks for the visit. Let's get down to business. Now here's your chance to show how much you really know. He might get grumpy if he can't stop you with Brazier's Quiz.
First question. As you mentioned, you went to Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda, Maryland. Which of these celebrities did not go to Walter Johnson High? I'm going to mention 4 celebrities. 3 went there, 1 did not. Okay, you got to tell me which one did not. Rock musician Nils Lofgren from Crazy Horse and E Street Band.
Right.
Actor Matt McCoy, who is Lloyd Brown in Seinfeld.
Right.
Was in some of the police academies. Gene Rayburn, host of Match Game. And Florent Groberg, who's a Medal of Honor recipient. So was it Nils Lofgren, Matt McCoy, Gene Rayburn, or Florent Groberg that did not go to Walter Johnson?
It's Gene Rayburn.
Bang.
Thank goodness. With that long microphone
microphone.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
I was going to put Charles Nelson Reilly, but I thought that might give it away too much.
And Matt McCoy was in my English class with Miss Mulhouse our junior year, and that's when he got the bug to become an actor.
Wow.
We did a one-act play. He did so well in it. Mrs. Mulhouse said, you should consider doing this long-term. That's where he got a start in Mrs. Mulhouse's 11th grade English class.
How about
class.
That? 11th grade. Right. Who would have known?
All right, so you went to the University of Maryland. Which of these celebrities did not go to Maryland? Okay, there's a lot to choose from. Larry David, creator of Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Ed Snyder, former owner of the Flyers and chair of Comcast Spectacore. Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein, investigative reporter. Or David Byrne, lead singer of the Talking Heads. So is it Larry David, Ed Snyder, Carl Bernstein, or David Byrne?
I'm going to say David Byrne.
David Byrne is correct.
Yes, that was
correct.
A guess. I knew if there was a Philly connection, he must have. All right, good.
He went to an art school in Maryland.
Whew. That makes sense.
I think it was the Maryland Institute of
Art
or something.
You're off and running, Tim.
Two for two. And we haven't even got to the baseball questions, of which this is the first one. So I made a bad assumption, and that's why I asked you if you were an Orioles fan growing up.
Right.
But you're a baseball fan, so you might get this. Who has the best single-season batting average in Orioles history? With a .420 average, surpassed only in Major League Baseball by Nat LaHoy and Rogers Hornsby. Okay? So it's the third highest single-season batting average. Is it George Sisler, Heinie Manouche, George Stone, or Baby Doll Jacobson?
It's George Sisler.
George Sisler is correct. I put some of those names in there because I wanted to say the name Heinie Manouche and Baby Doll Jacobson. All right, you are 3 for 3. All right. This is a John Kruk, former ESPN colleague John Kruk, and 2 other players became the first players in MLB history to open their half of the first inning with three consecutive solo home runs versus the Giants. Who were the other two? Was it Steve Garvey and Randy Reddy, Marvell Wynn and Tony Gwynn, Tony Gwynn and Joey Cora, or Stan Jefferson and Marvell Wynn?
Well, it was Gwynn and Wynn. I love that. And so they were the first ones to do it. And then, by the way, it's been done like four times since. Twice, J.J. Hardy, former shortstop, was in it with the Orioles and also with the Brewers. Yes,
right.
Marvell Wynn, Tony Gwynn, and John Cora.
You're not going to get Tim. There's no way I'm sneaking baseball questions by Tim.
It's true.
All right, this might throw you off a little bit. You are Armenian, of Armenian descent, right?
Right.
What is the capital of Armenia?
Oh, God.
Well, you have multiple choice. You have multiple choice. Is it, and I'm going to butcher these names, is it Yerevan, Dilijan, Norovank, or Jermuk? So is it Yerevan, Dilijan, Norovank, or Jermuk?
God, I am so bad with Armenian history. And by the way, I'm in the Armenian Sports Hall of Fame. Don't ask me how that happened.
Who else? Anybody else?
I was introduced in between Gero Yepremian and Ara Parsegian.
Wow.
So two greats.
I go to pick up my award, and I said, do you want me to make a speech? And they said, yes, we would love for you to speak, but you need to keep it to 30 seconds. 30 seconds. Wow. All right, one more time, and this is a total guess.
Well, what did you say in the 30 seconds?
I told a stupid Armenian story, which I'll tell you off the air. It's going to take too long.
All right, so you got Yerevan, Dilijan, Norovank, or Jermuk?
All right, Norovank C. Total guess.
Yerevan, so unfortunately. All right.
One wrong. God, I have the book.
The good news is the rest are baseball. So here you go.
Is this question number 7?
Question number 6.
6, okay.
You wrote a book called I'm Fascinated by Sacrifice Flies, Inside the Game We Love. Who has the most sacrifice flies in Major League Baseball history with 128? Okay. Do you know that? Do you even?
It should be Eddie Murray.
Eddie Murray is correct.
Bang.
How about that?
Never led the league in sacrifice flies in any season.
Really?
Yet has more than anyone in the history of the game. How weird is that?
That is very strange.
That's why I'm fascinated by sacrifice flies.
Right.
There are a million cool stats and notes about sacrifice flies. Believe me, I looked them all up.
And that's not a lost art, right?
Travis Jankowski, right? Former Philly, and still never hit a sacrifice fly. He's over 1,000 plate, over 1,000 plate appearances in his major league career. And sorry, Joey Gallo, 96 homers in the major leagues before he hit a sacrifice fly.
Whew.
Think about that.
That's crazy.
96
right there.
Balls right. over a fence before he hit a ball that was caught scoring a runner from third. That's impossible.
That's the beauty of baseball, right there. Numbers like that. All right. You are, I think, one away, right?
Actually, he's qualified for the book.
No, your math is wrong.
Two more
questions. You got one wrong.
Oh, he got one wrong. That's
right. Got Armenian wrong.
Fanatic's not good in math, by the way, Tim.
No.
All right, number 7. You were the Texas Rangers beat writer for the Dallas Morning News. We mentioned that from 81 to 85. Which pitcher had the most wins during that era with 61 wins? Was it – you want to take a guess off the –
It should be Charlie Huff.
Charlie Huff is
correct. Huff.
I was going to say Frank Tanana, Danny Darwin, or Doc Medich, but you got it off the top. Now you've officially qualified. You get that Fanatic
book.
But for the bonus round, you have one last question. You collected box scores. I think your son Jeff – and Jeff, by the way, his son Tom, I don't think you know this, is the morning show host on WSTU.
Of course I know. Of course.
We
did the morning show in spring training.
So we bonded down there, and it's great to have Jeff here. About to have his first – we don't know if it's a son or first baby, we'll say.
It's a girl, McKinley.
Oh, first girl.
McKinley right. Hope, right.
Congratulations.
All right, there you go. Is this a first-time grandfather?
No, I'm a two-time grandfather with my daughter, Kelly. I have Carson, 2, and Emma was just born 2 months ago.
Oh, wow. Right.
Living large.
Right.
Love it. All right, your last. So I think Jeff told me this in spring training. You collected box scores from every major league game from 1990 to 2009. Every game, right?
Yeah, 20 straight years without missing
every
a day.
Every game, box score.
Yeah, why did you do that?
Well, because the internet was not big back then. I have to cover all 30 teams because I'm not the beat writer anymore. I'm covering Sports Illustrated. I got to cover all the teams. So when I would go on a long plane flight, which I did all the time, and I needed to check out what the Padres are doing with their bullpen or whatever, I have all the box scores. And the box scores teach you an enormous amount if you read them closely, which, of course, I do every day.
All right, so knowing that you collected box scores, I found a unique game that on April 19th, 1996, the Texas Rangers beat which team 26-7. They scored 16 runs in the eighth inning. Do you remember
that
this
game? That was the Orioles.
Was the Orioles. I don't even need multiple choice.
Right. That was, and Manny Alexander pitched in that game. Yeah, that was a long story. Yeah. And by the way, the day that Jeffrey Kirchen went to his went to high school for the first time, they had orientation. That was the day that the Rangers beat the Orioles 30-3.
Ugh.
So I have to turn off my cell phone and go in for orientation. The score's 3-0 when I go in.
Right.
When I get home from his orientation, I get a call from the office, and they said, did you hear what happened in Baltimore? I thought someone died or a plane crashed into the stadium. He goes, the Rangers won 30-3. That's what I missed while I was making sure he had his high school orientation.
All right, one last one. And this is not – I'm not going to go through the names because only one person can do it. But I really love when you and Scott Van Pelt have a special relationship. I guess you both worked in ESPN, obviously.
Right.
And
we grew up in the same county, Montgomery County, Maryland, which is 50 miles from Baltimore, and yet they speak a different language in Baltimore than we do in Montgomery County.
Right. And I lived in Baltimore for 3 years, so I'm kind of somewhat familiar with the accent. But I was just, when he interviews you and starts talking about Joe Flacco and everything else, your laugh is just so, I mean, even if you don't know you, you're laughing with you because it's so funny just see that. So I was going through actually some of the, and I'm not going to do it because like Scott Van Pelt, but we actually have some good ones. We should give some of these to Scott Van Pelt. I mean, we had JT Realmuto right?
Really good.
Ricky Otero would have been a good one.
Right.
Calvin Maduro.
Ricky Otero.
Jeff Otero is two.
But I think we had Terry's dad, Tito Francona.
Tito?
That's about as good. Yep. But I think the best one of all time, and get Scott to do this next time if you're talking baseball, but who was a pitcher on the Phillies back in the 80s? Remember a Latino pitcher?
Antonio Bastardo?
No, that
was a different one.
Here, I want you to do that name right there.
Oh, Nino Espinoza. I can't do it like Scott. So here's how bad it was. People would send in requests to the Van Pelt show saying, you have to do this. I was in the grocery store at the Safeway in my neighborhood, and this guy comes up to me. I've never met him in my life. He attacks me in the frozen food aisle and says, please ask Scott to name the female goalie on the U.S. soccer team.
Yeah,
so I bring
Hope
it up.
Solo.
Solo. Yeah,
and
Hope
it was
Solo.
Hope Solo. It was the dumbest thing ever, and yet it just proves again, though, fellas, we're allowed to have a good laugh once in a while. We're covering baseball for a living. It's okay to have a good chuckle.
Right. Absolutely, and the magic of TV and the joy you can bring. So, Tim, really, this was a pleasure. We're getting ready for the Detroit game tonight, ALS Awareness Night. Again, thanks for being here for that. Enjoy the book.
I got a book. How about that?
And that's it, John. We're going to sign off. We'll see you next time on Phillies Backstage. Backstage with the Golden Blue.